Talk to you. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit download and play on your iPod, iPad, Surface, or computer, whatever device you're using. One of our top shows every year is the program I've done with Ron Hedges on his top 10 list of e-discovery cases. And we've done this the past 3 years. Ron spends a good deal of time tracking cases over the course of the year. And this show allows him really to display some of the nuggets he's encountered. And as a former judge, he's uniquely qualified to be doing this task. So we'll be talking about some of the trends and issues emerging from last year's cases. The list isn't in any particular order of importance. And last year, we began experimenting with adding an additional guest to the show to add some flavor and reaction. And this year, we've added Patricia Antizana from Reed Smith, who's a litigator there. And in terms of backgrounds, Ron Hedges served as United States Magistrate Judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007. He's a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board and participates in Sedona working groups on e-discovery and records, international e-discovery, confidentiality, public access. He's also the member of the advisory boards of the Advanced E-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Institutes of the Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches e-discovery and evidence as an adjunct faculty member. He's a wide number of publications, author of Discovery of Electronically Stored Information, Surveying the Legal Landscape from BNA 2007, and co-author of Managing Discovery of Electronic Information, A Pocket Guide of Judges from the Federal Judicial Center 2007. And he's also deeply involved with educating judges. Trish is the counsel at Reed Smith, Patricia Antizano. Trish, we'll be calling you Trish on this show, okay? who I also know, and obviously that's why I'm familiar with her. She's involved in the Records and E-Discovery Group at Reed Smith and focuses her practice on general litigation with a specialty in managing e-discovery issues. She's been involved with all phases of litigation, including management of large-scale discovery, has coordinated electronic and hard copy record collection, and managed large-scale review projects in numerous complex litigation matters. And the reason I asked her to be on the show is on January 8th, she published an article with David Cohen entitled 2013 E-Discovery Case Highlights. So I thought it was a natural fit. Before we start, I'd like to add that these are the views of the guests as individuals and do not reflect the views of their organizations, unless, of course, you're Ron Hedges, where they are one and the same. So let's start the show, Ron. Your first case on your list was Hixson versus City of Las Vegas, which was 2013, Westlaw 367-7203, District of Nevada, July 10th, 2013. And this case talked about the triggering event. So, Ron, what do you really like about this case? Tell us a little about it.
I enjoy reading it. It's an employment case, an adverse employment action. And there are allegations of wrongful conduct in the termination of an individual, a plaintiff. And it's interesting as you look at it because what we're seeing in the opinion is an escalating series of acts by the plaintiff filing some type of complaint to the client with her employer. There may be an informal comment. There's a letter going into an HR department. Finally, threats of litigation, something filed with an employment commission in Nevada. And all these events are going up to where the court says the duty to preserve arises. It's interesting because if you're a corporate entity, I would expect that anyone of a number of employees can complain about different things forever. And the mere fact that a complaint comes in about working conditions or the like can't realistically be the basis for the imposition of a duty to preserve. And this decision is a nice little discussion of escalating demands or escalating comments, finally getting to the point where there's a filing made with the state commission and then a decision by the court. You know, at this point, we're beyond the internal complaint stage and the like. Litigation is foreseeable, if not actually happening, and the duty preserve kicks in. So I just like it because it talks about within an organizational setting, what's an organization to do with someone who files these informal complaints and the like, and where up the ladder before the actual filing of a lawsuit does a duty preserve arise.
And Trish, is the triggering event really a critical issue from a litigator's perspective?
Absolutely. Triggering event, it's extremely important. It sort of sets the stage for determining when the duty to preserve documents and information arises. And then the parties can also defend their procedures for issuing a litigation hold and for retaining potentially relevant documents based on the triggering date. And as Ron mentioned in Hickson specifically, if the triggering event would have been further up the line, would have been plaintiff's initial email complaint earlier in the same year as she filed her Equal Rights Commission complaint, the court may have very well decided, including other factors, to grant the plaintiff's motion for sanctions based on the city's deletion of the subsequent emails.
Yeah, and as we heard from a prior year doing this show, pension committee and other cases, once you've deleted something, you can get in a mess of trouble if you haven't properly preserved. So, but we'll be addressing those issues later in this show. There have been more cases in that area. Your next case was Sims versus the Geller Attractions, Inc., which is a 2013 Westlaw 49756, Western District of Virginia, from January 2nd, 2013. And this is the scope of the duty to preserve, which is, related, the next step after your preservation. So, Ron, why don't you tell us about this case and what it tells you about what you do after the triggering event, which is preserve data?
Well, I have to begin by telling you that just on the facts, this was my favorite case of 2013, and it's a year old now. Interesting, though, I'm sure a lot of us have been to city fairs, county fairs, or the like, where there were roller coasters put up. And roller coasters are put up by traveling companies, basically. And some people got on a roller coaster in Virginia, and something went wrong with the roller coaster. The car it stopped unexpectedly, and the car was bumped by another car behind it. And the allegation of the plaintiff, obviously, is that the roller coaster was not properly maintained or used. But the defendant, the roller coaster operator, has an interesting argument that one of the plaintiffs had a hat on. It was contrary to the rules. He was told to take it off. And if you go on these devices, you remember that when you get to the bottom, a picture is taken, and you have an opportunity to get a picture of yourself screaming on the roller coaster. So these pictures are taken. They're normally overwritten. They're not preserved. And at the time this happened, the image of the plaintiff with the cap on was preserved, and nothing else was. And one of the defenses is of this individual who was injured, I wasn't the only one who was wearing. A lot of people were, and I was not told I couldn't. The other interesting thing about all this, of course, is the hat that he was wearing, or something that looked like it, was found in the braking mechanism of the car that he was on. So the question becomes, was it appropriate for the defendant, the company, to keep the image of him and his car, the plaintiff, or should they have kept images from everyone else at the time? And my argument would be, look, the only thing they knew at the time was that he had a hat on. He shouldn't have had it on. The counter argument, and some people have argued this with me back and forth, they knew that the hat was going to be an issue and they should have kept everything else. But the court came down and said, no, you only have to keep the information on the hat or on the picture of this one guy. So it's fascinating to me on this question of scope.
Interesting. I don't know if you have any reaction to that one, Trish.
Yeah, I actually do. I found the case very interesting as well. I've worked on a lot of product liability cases. And what I found most interesting was this reasonableness consideration by the court, whether the employees of the park actually knew that photos of other riders would be material in any way. And the court noted that it was not convinced that these employees of the park reasonably should have known that the photos of the other riders would be relevant. So the court's consistent focus on reasonableness as a key consideration on determining the scope of the duty to preserve, and then also prejudice. The court recognized that there was the prejudice to the other parties wasn't very severe because there were parties and witnesses who had testified regarding whether other people were wearing hats or not.
Interesting. Yeah, all these. Whenever you get a fact-specific case like this, you wonder how it plays out in the next case. But I did, those are great facts, Ron. Nice case. The third case here, I really like because it dives into the social media area, which is a mess all litigants face, and it's Gatto versus United Airlines, 2013 Westlaw 128-5285, District of New Jersey, March 25th, 2013. Your old area, Ron, in New Jersey, and it's about possession, custody, or control in the context of social media and spoliation. Tell us about this case and why you think it's important.
There is a lot of case law we're going to be seeing on social media. Obviously, it goes particularly into something that some folks have started to call asymmetric discovery or asymmetric litigation, where a defendant may have enormous amounts of information and a plaintiff may have a little or none. And here we have an instance where there was information, apparently relevant information, available on the social media pages of the plaintiff, and it became unavailable. And it really became unavailable because of conduct by him. So this goes back to Rule 34A of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, possession, custody, or control. And the question is that this individual obviously did not own Facebook or whatever social media site he had pages up on, but he had an ability to take certain acts to maintain information, and he failed to do that. And that was considered to be spoliation and sanctionable conduct.
Okay.
So talks about it. It's expanding possession, custody, or control, and I think we're going to find as we go forward with all this that really what a court is going to have to do, once it's gone through the decisions as to whether or not this type of information is even discoverable under Rule 26b-1, is look at the terms of agreement or service between someone like Mr. Gatto and Facebook or the like, and decide whether under those conditions the plaintiff or the individual with the account did have possession, custody, or control, as that is defined by the case law.
And Ron, what jumped out at me as well was it was unclear in this case what was the information on the public Facebook site or on a private site. And many of these social media cases talk about some sort of threshold showing to quote-unquote open the door to private materials. And in this case, there wasn't any focus on that, you know, as we've seen some of the other courts do.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. We really aren't very specific as to what's here, but the case law has developed over the past few years. Really what happens in most situations is a party will look at publicly available pages or whatever that an individual has and discern from that that there's something on there that is discoverable, and on the basis of that try to get access to content either in private pages or in different communications or the like, and that implicates questions of the Stored Communications Act as to whether or not a provider can be required to turn that over. And then the courts have to go through a dance about, well, does the attorney look at it and turn it over? Does it go to a special master? Does the judge do it ex parte or in camera? So there's a lot going on in here that really hasn't been explored that much. We're starting to see it, and obviously social media is so prevalent now, will seem.
I'm still waiting for it to get clearer before I put a Facebook page up. So that's on my list of maybe three reasons why I haven't put one up. But anyway, your next case gets you into my professional territory of TAR, In Re Biomet, which is 2013, Westlaw 1729682, which is one of the opinions, the first big opinion, Southern District of Indiana, April 18th, 2013, on search terms in TAR. Let's talk about this case. I'm going to warn you, I have some strong feelings about it. We did a pretty extensive podcast on it last year, so maybe I'll discuss this with you instead of Trish, because my feelings are pretty defined at this point.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, there's not much to say about this decision. A party had been served the request. The party responded to the request. And after that's done, someone else comes in and says, let's use computer-assisted research or technology-assisted review or predictive coding or whatever language you want to use. And for me, more than anything else, what this decision really talks about, Carl, is if you want to try something to be done in a way, you need to talk about it front up. Because generally speaking, courts require parties to go back and duplicate things when they've been done already. That's what this means to me. As far as TAR generally goes, we have not had any decision that's ever really approved TAR. When we've seen the results of TAR, we've had a couple decisions that say, okay, go and do it. But we really haven't seen much testing of it yet. And that's probably something that's going to happen in 2014. Using technology-assisted review obviously brings up a lot of other issues. We know someone, Carl, that will never turn over her seed set to the other side because she thinks that's work product. I disagree with that. I think if that's how you decide to begin, if something is work product, the work product is still discoverable when certain conditions are met. So it's interesting. Sooner or later, we're going to see a court have to look at the contested results of technology-assisted review, but biomed is not it. We have not seen that yet.
Yeah, I don't disagree with much of what you're saying in there. I also think that what we may see more than likely, it won't be a challenge on the results of a TAR case. It'll be a challenge on the results of a party that didn't want to use TAR, used traditional method, and someone decides to lift up the rock and challenge those results.
And we've seen that. And that's done every now and then. And interestingly, one way that courts have allowed that is because of a 26G1 certification that a party signs when they're making a reduction and saying, basically, we've done our best, more or less. And when discrepancies come up, then courts say, you know what, that may be a 26G1 violation. I'm going to let you investigate it further to see what's going on.
Yeah, I just wrote an article with Tom Gricks on 26G and TAR, and you know, my theory is that the next cases will go even further than prior cases and may ask for more work to be done, simply because, you know, the people that are pushing to use TAR sometimes, you know, lose that argument, especially if it's not their process. The producing party wants to use, you know, more traditional keyword-driven approach, and I think that's where the results will get focused on. You know, what I didn't love about this case was it focused rather substantially on proportionality for supporting the approach of using keyword culling and allowing a process to go forward, because frankly a lot of money had already been spent in that case. So I think you're right, getting this issue up front and really getting the court involved if you can before money has been spent is critical. It didn't focus much on the actual results, which I thought on recall were pretty poor. Most of the experts in the space agree that the recall results were not great. And I think this transparency issue is where we're going to see also a lot more discussion, for sure, because money gets spent if it's not transparent. That's my position. It's like agreeing on keywords. If you can agree on how you trained, similar result, less fight. Case moves forward. Anyway,
but there's so much going on in this opinion. It's a question of parties having to do so over again. What kind of media confers existed before? I just think there's a fascinating area to be pursued involving computer-assisted research, and more often than not, it's going to come back to party agreement at the beginning, because there's a decision that just came out within the last month that says basically the state of the art of search now is not search words or search terms or using roots or this or that. It is those things, not even talking about computer-assisted review, although that's a computer-assisted review in a way. So it's interesting to see where everything's going to wind up within the next year or two.
Absolutely. Let's move into that next area so I don't get accused of being TAR dominant here, because there are plenty of other cases. The next case is Rajala versus McGuire Woods, 2013, Westlaw 2949582, District of Kansas, January 3rd, 2013. And it impacts Rule 502D. And as a side question, is Judge Grimm helping you with this list to keep 502D front and center in everyone's mind? So why don't you tell us about this case?
The first question is, what does Judge Wacky think about this? Because he's a big proponent of 502D.
That's true.
And this is his opinion. 502D, it's the forgotten rule. I hate to say it. I have gone and spoken in a lot of places. As I go out and speak to the bar, the level of knowledge on this rule is decreasing. And I think really it is because, as a general proposition, lawyers say to themselves, I'm never going to agree with somebody on the other side to do something that may, if you will, make it easier for me to avoid privilege loss or whatever. All 502D says is you and I can enter into an agreement, and if it is signed as an order, if any of us make some type of inadvertent production or the like, it's never a waiver. I go around to people and say, I can't imagine what the downside is. It doesn't require you to do anything. It doesn't require you to do any kind of a search. It doesn't say you don't have to. It just protects you. And this decision basically says that. In this decision, Judge Waxy signed a 502D order over the opposition of one party. And quite frankly, I don't even know what the opposition was. But it's a very it's an underutilized rule. Forget about being underutilized. It's not even known. I don't know what we have done as educators to fail to tell people about this rule, but it's a powerful tool that protects you against waiver, and it's just not used.
I've always thought it's a marketing issue, and I've always thought that we should analogize it to practicing safe sex. it's a prophylactic. It basically protects you from information going out there. And if we could get some, you know, marketing like that about it, you know, it might get more notice. I have a theory on this too. And Trish, your firm is like a handful of firms out there that's got a practice group specifically devoted to e-discovery. You know, what's your experience with 502D? Has it become easier to get people to use a technical rule when you have a group of people that are focused in this area, would you think, as opposed to, you know, a bunch of litigators trying to learn e-discovery, you know, as it goes along?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the group of people is, you know, well aware of Judge Grimm's advice to have a 502D order. And then this analysis from the Rajala court just reemphasizes that it's a sound practice to request the order. And the team's, you know, every member of the team's aware of it and aware of the court's focus on reducing the time and the cost spent these days on privilege reviews and these expansive privilege logs.
Yep. So, well, let's go into the next area now, the sixth case. And now we get into the mess on sanctions, which hopefully the proposed new federal rules may clean up in a few years if and when they get passed. But until then, we still need to be wary of differing standards on spoliation. And you contrasted two cases, Herman v. Rain Link, Inc., 2013 Westlaw 4028759, District, Kansas, August 7, 2013, and Psychosui, American Corp. versus Hart, 2013 Westlaw 4116322, Southern District, New York, August 15, 2013. So, you know, we've got some varying standards here in spoliation. Ron, why don't you contrast the case and explain the issue?
Well, as an immediate question or immediate comment with regard to your suggestion about the rules being amended, just to tell everyone who may be listening, the earliest date that a rule will change will be in December of 2015, so we got a long way to go, and we don't know what the form of any rule amendment may look at. The proposal is to change Rule 37E to some degree, but put that aside. Let's deal with the here and now. There are two decisions I put in here. One is Herman. Herman is a decision out of the 10th Circuit, Kansas, and the 10th Circuit, I may be wrong, but in any event, it's out of a Midwestern Circuit. And the other one is the Southern District of New York, written by Shara Shinland out of the Second Circuit. And what these two decisions really do, very simply, is distinguish between what kind of a showing is necessary for the imposition of sanctions as far as scienter goes. The Herman decision talks about case law requiring some type of conduct, not negligence, but something, wrongful conduct one way or the other, with some type of a guilty or purposeful state of mind. Those of you who have read Judge Shinland's opinions and seen Second Circuit law know that in the Second Circuit, negligence and gross negligence is sufficient for the imposition of sanctions. And these decisions are also important because they talk about inferences to draw if there is a culpable state of mind. And, for example, do you presume relevance? Do you presume prejudice? Or does a showing have to be made by the party seeking the imposition of sanctions? The other interesting thing, of course, all this, Carl, is that we've got case law varying all over the country on that. Even within district court, you're going to see variations on what individual judges is enough. So the landscape is everywhere. If I were a company that did business in all 50 states and all of the federal courts, I would obviously have to gear my litigation strategy to the worst, if you will, jurisdiction, which is a jurisdiction, for example, New York, where negligence is enough. So it's interesting. I expect Trish would have a lot more to talk about from the client point of view than I would. But as I say, the earliest change in this may be in December of 2015, if something ever happens. We're assuming it's constitutional review after it does. So it's going to be interesting to see.
Trish, you wrote quite a bit in your article about different cases, and Saikatsui was one of them. Did Ron hit the nail correctly with a hammer here that just makes it really hard for your clients?
He definitely did. You know, two questions: what's the appropriate culpable state of mind? Is negligence enough? Must it be gross negligence? And by the way, what is willfulness? How is that defined? And then also, when can prejudice or relevance of the destroyed documents be presumed? I hadn't read the Herman case. I read that and from the Tenth Circuit's point of view, it's necessary, no matter what, to demonstrate the prejudice, to show that the destroyed evidence was relevant to the party's claims or defenses. And then the contrast with the Southern District of New York and Judge Shinland, where, you know, a willfulness finding is enough to satisfy the culpable state of mind, and then prejudice may be presumed from that willfulness finding. But again, how do we define willfulness? With the Saikatsui opinion, it seemed like the intentional acts were enough. There wasn't any bad faith. So then it seems that the potential for a party acting in good faith, doing something it shouldn't be doing, but in good faith, being hit with sanctions. And then we also looked at the Research Foundation case from the Northern District of New York, where the Northern District denied a motion for sanctions, recognizing that gross negligence was enough to satisfy the culpable state of mind, but also that the defendant needed to produce evidence that the destroyed documents were relevant. So gross negligence was enough, but it was not enough to presume prejudice or relevance of the missing documents.
Yeah, the other interesting thing with this, Carl, is that Saikatsui, there was a big discussion by Judge Shinland about jury instructions, and it's a non-jury case. So it's kind of fascinating as to how this is going to turn out if the case goes forward. And what you do with adverse inferences when a judge is sitting as a finder of fact, as opposed to telling the jury what it can think about or not think about.
Yeah, I just have a real difficult time with pushing this into the negligence area because, I mean, you know, look at that your roller coaster case, for example, when you're dealing with people that are operating carnival rides and setting them up and down. Now, obviously, the lawyer's got to step in. The lawyer's the only one that really understands these standards very well and make clear instruction. But I just think negligence gets harder and harder when you look at different types of corporate entities and different structures and different people, and how do you police all of them? It just really seems very messy. So glad I don't litigate.
I suppose
It's the question becomes, of course, you know, we hold people responsible for negligent conduct every day, especially in motor vehicle accidents. It's the easiest example to tell anybody about. And I suppose an argument that can be made is, now look, you make a mistake, someone suffers for it, you should pay for it.
And that, in a nutshell, is the argument of why negligence should be sufficient for the imposition of sanctions. And on the other hand, the argument is, look, spoliation means doing something on purpose to hurt someone or to do something. And we want people to be reasonable. If they're reasonable and make a mistake, we don't want to punish them for doing that. And I think that, in a nutshell, is what the argument's going to be about, and it's going to be played out through the rule amendment process now.
Well, we'll see where it ends up. I'm glad you've included a criminal law case here. I think e-discovery benefits from some of the criminal cases that are out there, and you included United States versus Brooks, 715 Federal 3rd, 1069 8th Circuit from 2013 on the admissibility of ESI. And why do you think this case is important?
There isn't much case law on admissibility of ESI for the simple reason, for example, in the federal system, that about 1% of cases go to trial. And this decision looks at the federal rules of evidence, and the federal rules of evidence are applicable on the civil as well as the criminal side, and looks at whether or not something could be admissible as a business record or as a hearsay exception or whether something can be authenticated properly through a different type of device, which is the same under the civil and the criminal side. So it's only in here as a reminder to everyone that, look, you look at the federal rules of evidence, you look at authentication under the federal rules of evidence, whether it's civil or criminal, and you use the basic things that we learned in law school whenever we went, and we apply them across the board. And ESI is just another piece of evidence that fits in to the evidentiary puzzle. And here, if I was going to invoke Paul Grimm, this is where I would do it, because Paul's a big writer and speaker on the federal rules and the federal rules applicability here. And the Lorraine decision that he wrote several years ago is kind of a primer on how you get ESI into evidence. So Briggs is just here because it's a recent decision that talks about admissibility under the federal rules of evidence.
I wish I could remember. I must be getting older here. Lost for the name of the judge in Minnesota who's retired, district court judge, who wrote this great article on a fake rule of evidence on admitting all emails for as a business record, because no one ever challenges this. We did a podcast years ago with Jonathan Redgrave on it. Name escapes me, but anyway, I think having some case law here is obviously helpful. So good. Good to add that to the list. Your list then ends with the critical issue of competence of outside counsel, and you had a couple cases here. Ellis versus Toshiba American Info Systems, which is on a California court appellate opinion from August 7, 2013, and State versus Scholes, 2013 Westlaw 2631693, New Jersey Supreme Court, June 13, 2013. So why don't we talk about this issue, which impacts all lawyers?
Well, some of you or all of you may know that in August of 2012, the Model Rules of Professional Conduct were amended by the House of Delegates of the ABA to, under competence for 1.1, add to a comment the fact that you should know about the benefits and risks of technology. The Scholes decision is fascinating. It's another criminal case. And really what we saw in Scholes is the Supreme Court of New Jersey saying, look, you as a lawyer, if you don't know this stuff, you need to find someone to help you. And that may be another lawyer or it may be a technical advisor and the like. So I think stands for the proposition that maybe an attorney doesn't need to know everything, but the attorney has to need to know when he needs help. And it's very important in Scholes' child pornography case under New Jersey, there's something called the open file discovery rule in criminal cases, which means the state has to share everything with you. And the question becomes, how does an attorney look at the child pornography that's going to be offered against his client? And in context of that, we have discussion of what do you need to be able to do that? How do you secure it? How do you access it? So that's a fascinating question about getting help. And then Toshiba's, you know, it wasn't fun for the attorney involved, but it's another one of those fun cases where an attorney wanted to get fees. Something went very wrong with what the attorney was trying to do to get a fee petition in. And if you read it, I think you're going to see a judge throws up his hands and say, look, you got to know how to do this stuff. And if you don't know how to do it, you're not going to get a fee award. So I think we're coming to the point, and there's a big debate now, I think, Carl, going on about how much information does someone have to know to be competent. And my answer to that is you need to know when you have to ask help if you don't understand it yourself. And we're going to see more and more of this as this goes on. There's been a decision in the Third Circuit on Rule 11 sanctions, the equivalent of Rule 11 sanctions, where an attorney was sanctioned for something he didn't do with regard to ESI in making a filing complaint or a petition. And we're probably going to see it under Rule 26G1 at some point, where attorneys are making representations and the representations turn out not to be right. So this is going to expand and we're going to see more of it as we go forward, I think.
I was telling Trish before you got on the call, over the course of the last year, I taught this predictive coding course in 9 different cities as a CLE program. And my view on the narrower issue of search, which is the 26G1 issue you just raised, the knowledge of technology is somewhat overwhelming because there's so many different tools out there. So I characterize it more as having a knowledge of statistics and understanding how measurement helps you evaluate results, not the underlying technology. But I did open a fortune cookie just before New Year's, which said, don't always trust statistics, which just made me laugh. It's the most applicable fortune cookie I've ever opened. So now I'm beginning to wonder a little bit.
But I have to tell you before we go forward, you know, most of us went to law school because we didn't know statistics.
Yes.
And we didn't want to know statistics. So.
But I sampled the room every time I started the class, and I asked how many of you have ever done software development and coding, and only a few people raised their hands. How many of you have taken statistics? Virtually every attendee who's a lawyer has at least taken one statistics class. So I think we got a better chance there. But you're right, they all hated it, so then they went to law school. So, Trish, your reaction in this area?
Yeah, you know, it's as there are more and more technological advances, the lawyers are either, as Ron mentioned, going to have to learn about them and know about them to be competent under the professional rules or hire somebody who does.
So let's move into the last area here, which comes out of some of your work and on your article, Trish. You had an additional thread of cases that touched on attorney fees and taxation of costs. And I know there was a big debate of that at the beginning of the Georgetown conference. You want to talk to us about Country Vintner of North Carolina versus E&J Winery Inc., which is 718 Fed Third 249 Fourth Circuit 2013. Contrasted with Gabriel Technologies Corp. versus Qualcomm, which is 2013 Westlaw 410103, Southern District, California, Feb. 1, 2013.
Sure. Looking at Country Vintner, some the court cites to the Third Circuit's reasoning in the Race Tires case, which many of you may have read about, regarding an analysis of what expenses related to electronic information discovery are taxable under the federal taxation of costs statute. And the statute has been read quite narrowly. In Country Vintner, the Fourth Circuit decided that only the costs of actually converting the electronic files to non-editable formats like TIFF and transferring those files to disks are taxable. So there wasn't very much there, and there's also a decision, a very recent decision out of the Federal Circuit, CBT Flint partners that where the court interpreted the taxation of costs statute a little bit more broadly, but not much more broadly than the Fourth Circuit. And in the CBT Flint Partners case, the court decided that taxable costs included converting the documents to a uniform production format to produce an image and its metadata, and also converting documents to a non-editable format. So they're in agreement with Country Vintner there. Also creating load files and scanning the documents, and finally copying the documents onto production media. So those are the taxable costs, and the court divided the e-discovery costs into three categories and noted that costs for organizing or indexing or deduplication and filtering, analysis, searching, those costs that can really add up, are not recoverable under this taxation of cost statute. But if you can find something else, like a state or federal statute regarding an award of attorney's fees, you might be able to recoup some costs, and that's where the Gabriel Technologies case comes in. In Gabriel Technologies, out of the Southern District of California, the court awarded the defendants more than $12.4 million in attorney's fees under these federal and state statutes, which permitted an award of attorney's fees in patent or trade secret cases. And within that award, more than $2.8 million was included for what the court termed, and the parties termed, quote, computer-assisted, algorithm-driven document review. So it looks like, you know, under the federal taxation of cost statute, the courts are leaning towards a narrow interpretation, but are more willing to award costs if there's some sort of other statutory basis for it.
Well, that's getting awarded costs is always of interest to law firms, especially the ones that win. Although the ones that lose, it's also of interest. I know some people that have fallen in that bucket. So, so good line of cases there to stay on top of from 2013. Well, I think this has been a fairly comprehensive show this year, so I won't put you both on the spot completely, but do you have any predictions on what next year's hot topics might be that courts might grapple with? And I know it's January 15th, and we don't control the issues a court will decide. So maybe I'll phrase this as, do you see any issue particular that seems to be the most vexing right now in e-discovery? Trish, you get to go first here, and Ron, you can go second.
All right, I can do that. Well, as you said, predictions are always difficult, and it's going to be hard to predict 2014, but I'm going to follow on some of the issues we discussed from 2013. I think there's going to be a continued focus on the appropriate standard for awarding sanctions for spoliation of evidence, and we'll see that as the discussion with the proposed amendments to the federal rules continues on. We're going to attempt to address these standards, you know, regarding willfulness. Is it willfulness and bad faith or bad faith? What about the prejudice requirement? So we'll see what type of a variation of the culpable state of mind we might see, what survives from that, and then also whether the distinction between sanctions and curative measures is addressed, which the courts may have an opportunity to do. And also, I think courts will continue to grapple with trying to maintain proportionality in electronic discovery. That's been a big issue. I think it will continue to be perhaps some analysis under Rule 26G or 26B2C. And I suspect more opinions may surface regarding that balancing act, balancing the burdens and the expenses on the producing party versus the likely benefit of the proposed discovery.
Ron, how about you?
I would echo everything that Trish just said, but the one item I would throw in, we're going to be in the year of privacy. No question about it. After everything that happened, if nothing else, with Target and the like, we're going to see an increased emphasis both on a regulatory side and on a litigation side to deal with privacy breaches and privacy enforcement and the like. So that's one of the big topics I think we're going to see this year. I don't see anything on the horizon that the Supreme Court is going to do that's going to make a difference with anything. So we'll have to see how that all turns out. But it, you know, as always, it's going to be a fun year, I think.
Yeah, and I'll be rather narrow. Although I think both your issues that you raised are certainly good ones. I'm hoping that we get some more focus on the transparency issue. After doing this boot camp around the country on predictive coding, I can tell you that judges are all over the place on this issue. While I see the proportionality arguments that are raised as being, you know, as you say, Ron, one of the biggest themes in e-discovery, I see the lack of transparency can artificially drive up the costs and create a proportionality argument that could have been short-circuited early on. And these are, you know, high-level themes that don't really intersect well with the rules. And I know I got to write a comment to the rules amendments, and I'm on several drafts of it, but that's sort of what I'm looking for on my list to see if something like that comes up. I just want to thank both of you, Trish and Ron, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I know, Ron, we talked about one that I definitely want to do at some point. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnaw, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can remember our show and website phonetically because it sounds out as Easy Bytes. But however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.